Before Pesach, we had been discussing the various reasons given for the Holocaust. I'm not going to review again on in what context we're speaking about reasons and causes of the Holocaust. If you don't remember, there's a tape somewhere of it, so listen to it again. We're chas v'sholom not trying to find causes to blame the people who are the victims, but to understand for ourselves what kinds of things can cause catastrophes like that, and to learn the lessons for ourselves. We discussed in great detail the cause that's attributed to assimilation, and why assimilation causes anti-Semitism, and anti-Semitism caused the terrible catastrophe of the Holocaust. A second idea that some Gedolei Israel, including those who went through the Holocaust, and we said those people have a right more to speak than anyone else, they attribute the catastrophe, or one of the contributing factors, to be the development of secular Zionism. And that needs explanation. Why would secular Zionism and the desire, seemingly, to settle in Eretz Israel be a bad thing? So just happens to work out that we're speaking about this before Yom HaTzmaut. So we'll review a lot that we've said in the past. When I first came here 23 years ago, the first Yom HaTzmaut, we had a drasha of the Shabbos before for about 2 hours, like a Shabbos HaGadol drasha, to explain what we were going to be doing on Yom HaTzmaut from then on, which was a radical change from what was done before I came, to say the least. Baruch Hashem, there are only 11 families here then, and it was very easy to explain and to speak or whatever, and to establish what we have been doing more or less since then and what. Part of what I said then is what I'm going to repeat now. First of all, let's put into perspective the movement called secular Zionism, what its aims were, what its purpose was, and what it wasn't. Let's put it first into perspective in the backdrop of Bichlal, settlement of Eretz Israel. Settlement of Eretz Israel in modern times did not start with the secular Zionist movement. It was preceded by about 200 years with a movement of settling Eretz Israel that was motivated by Gedolei Israel. It's interesting, I think, in the World Book, just as you should know, from the things that we know about, you can know how false the information is and the things you don't know about. I was reading an article on Judaism. It said there that after the destruction of the Second Temple, so there were Jews who were not interested in returning to Israel, but there's always a group of the Zionists who were interested in returning to Israel. As if the Zionist movement started right after the destruction of the Second Temple, and there were two groups in Judaism, the groups that wanted to go back to Eretz Israel, and the Zionists, and the ones who didn't go. And they write Zionists with capital Z, as if there was a movement called Zionism that existed from Churban Bayis Sheni, which is obviously Narishkeit, and there wasn't a group amongst Klal Yisrael that weren't interested in going back to Eretz Israel constantly. So in any case, the surge to resettle Eretz Israel, the desire in modern times Okay, there was a surge in the Middle Ages amongst the Baliatostos, but in modern times, in the last 250 years, was initiated by the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon. Both of them wanted to come and settle in Eretz Yisrael, and they felt that if they would settle in Eretz Yisrael and be Mekayim the Mitzvos HaKluyos Ba'aretz, it would help bring Mashiach. Both of them. Both of them were prevented from coming here themselves for reasons beyond understanding. There's no explanation of the Vilna Gaon already set out and was turned back, and the same thing with the Baal Shem Tov. For whatever reason, the Rabban Shalom had his plans, and those two Gedolim were not supposed to be here in Eretz Yisrael, just like Moshe Rabbeinu. However, they both sent their Talmidim to settle in Eretz Yisrael. The Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov settled predominantly in Tzfas and in Tveria, in those areas in the north, and because of, for various reasons, it was very difficult to settle in Yerushalayim. And the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon settled basically in Yerushalayim and Hebron, more in the central and south. And they built up a yishuv, the yishuv Hayasha, which we call today, or Meisharim, or whatever, was basically started by the Prushim, the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. And they originally were people who basically were sitting and learning Torah and supported by nedavos from people in Chutz Laretz. But eventually they went away from the old city and opened the new areas, which were what's called Meisharim, was the new Yishuv HaChadash at some point. And they also began settlements. The original settlements, Petach Tikva, and the first one was, Rishon LeZion could be, but there was another one closer to Yerushalayim that was basically agricultural settlement in order to mekayim the mitzvos HaKluyos Ba'aretz. Could be, I don't remember. It's Rabbi Yaakov Rivlin. Rivlin was the were set up in order to mekayim the mitzvahs of Kliyas Baritz, and again, to help bring Mashiach. That was the intention. That was in the early 1800s. In the mid-1800s, 1860, 1870, a organized group was formed in Europe called Chovavei Tzion. Chovavei Tzion preceded the Zionist movement by about 30 years. And its purpose was to establish settlements in Eretz Yisrael with the help of Montefiore, and to be Mekayim Mitzvos HaKluyos Ba'aretz, and to have Jews settle in Eretz Yisrael. Chovavei Tzion was Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, Rav Yehuda Alkali. These are people who were behind it. There also were secular people behind it. But the major, Shmuel Moliver. These were the people who, were behind it. Most of them were from Rabbanim. There were secular people who also joined the organization and were even part of the leadership of the organization. It was supported by many Gedolim, and it was opposed by many Gedolim. It was supported by the Netziv, the Chovavei Tzion. It was opposed by Rosh Hashanah Shmuel Hirsch. Rosh Hashanah Shmuel Hirsch opposed these attempts to resettle Eretz Yisrael in an organized fashion. The part of the reason why it was... I was also opposed by the Hungarian Gedolim. There was a shaila whether it was allowed to resettle Eretz Yisrael en masse or not. To have, what they wanted to do is to buy land from the Turks, who were in charge of control of Eretz Yisrael at the time, and to set up Jewish settlements. They weren't interested in making a Jewish state. That idea never dawned on them. To have a political autonomy. But Lamaisa, to what's it called, to settle Eretz Israel, and to have organized settlements in Eretz Israel as a place where Jews could escape from Europe and settle in Eretz Israel. That was the basic plan. And there were Gedolim who held that that's a very positive thing. In the kind of mitzvahs of Tluyas Ba'aretz, settling in Eretz Israel is a mitzvah. Others held that there's a prohibition that we accepted, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu imposed upon us when we went into Golus, that Shlo Yalu B'choma, that we would not leave Golus until the Rabbanu Shel Olam brought Mashiach. En masse, we wouldn't leave Golus and settle Eretz Yisrael forcibly. We wouldn't take Eretz Yisrael by force. And there's a machlokas what that means. Some say that any attempt to, in en masse, settle Eretz Yisrael in time of Golus is awesome. No matter what. It's individuals can go and live in Eretz Yisrael, but organizations that try to make mass aliyah is awesome. That's one opinion. Second opinion is that any kind of coercion, mass aliyah is also okay. It's not going to be the whole Klal Yisrael. Even to make it possible for groups of Jews to make aliyah is okay. But you can't take Eretz Yisrael back forcibly, even political force. Even through bribery and through whatever the message that they, political machinations, also called the choma. That's awesome. That's the second opinion. The third opinion is that it's only if you take it by physical force to make a war against the nations that are at the time in control of Eretz Israel, to take it away from them, that we're not allowed to do. But any other way, political, right, bribery, whatever it may be, not physical force is okay. And most Gedolei Israel held the third way. The Or Sameach said the Feirish, that once the nations of the world voted, either he was before them, the United Nations vote, but in San Remo, when they were dividing up the world after World War I, and they said that England would have the mandate on Palestine, and they had the Balfour Declaration that the English were positively predisposed to give a homeland to the Jews in Eretz Israel, then the prohibition of taking Eretz Israel by force didn't apply anymore. The nations of the world gave it to us, the people who were in charge. We'll see as we develop this that as things progressed, there were different opinions. Eventually, before the state was declared, the Satmar Rebbe had a different shita. Because of the political realities of what was going on. But that we'll get to in a little while. In any case, so there were those that opposed these groups, even though they were from, of settling Eretz Israel, but most Gedolim were pretty much for them and supported them and looked at settling Eretz Israel as a very positive thing. And this is all pre- secular Zionism. The Zionist movement didn't exist at the time. The Zionist movement came about in the late 1890s. And it was the idea of Theodor Herzl. Herzl was a Viennese journalist who basically was assimilated, religiously for sure, socially. His parents were pretty much assimilated Jews, so you can't blame him too much for not knowing too much about Yiddishkeit. He was extremely bothered by anti-Semitism. The fact that Jews suffered bothered him. And I always say, and I always get flack for it from some people, that I'm sure that the Rebbeinu Shlomo will reward him for that feeling. And even if you don't have kavanah l'shem mitzvah, right, but it bothers you that Jews suffer, I'm sure that the Rabban Shem will reward that. But his solutions were horrendous, and I doubt if he'll be rewarded for his solutions. His first solution, years before he formulated the idea of Zionism, his first solution to anti-Semitism was mass conversion to Catholicism. He figured that the Goyim hate us because of our religion, because we killed their God, whatever it may be. So the roots of anti-Semitism are religious. So if we all convert to Catholicism, there won't be any more anti-Semitism. Makes sense. If there's no Semites, you can't have anti-Semites. So he envisioned, he wrote in his diary, that the proudest day he could think of is the day that the people of his town will march with the Catholic priest to the church and all be baptized. And he envisioned more than that, that they would convince the Pope to accept all Jews as Christians, and that en masse, all the Jews of Europe would come to Rome and be baptized by the Pope. He had these grandiose ideas. I don't think the Pope was interested, not at least as much as Herzl was. In any case, he didn't remain with this idea too long. He didn't pursue it, because after the Dreyfus trial, Dreyfus was an officer in the French army who was libeled, that he was a traitor, a spy, and was put into prison and ejected from the army in shame, and it was all a libel. It was all anti-Semitic. It caused tremendous anti-Semitic repercussions all over Europe. And Dreyfus was a totally assimilated Jew. So Herzl realized it doesn't help. It's not religious Jews that the Goyim can't stand. They can't stand any Jews. So converting to Catholicism is not going to help. Not going to help. It's still going to be problematic. So he came up with another idea. The other idea is the idea of Zionism. He didn't coin the name. I don't remember who did. In fact, I think it was, what's his name? Birnbaum. Birnbaum? Yeah. What's it called? Who originally was a secular Jew who became then a part of Mizrahi, and then eventually became part of the Aguda. Rav Nosson Birnbaum. He was what coined the term, Zionism. So what was the theory? The theory of secular Zionism was that the reason that Goyim hate us is because we're not normal. We live in other people's lands, we speak their language, we make use of their services and their economy, and therefore we're parasites. And the Goyim hate us because we're parasites, because we're not normal. We're not a normal people. If we'd only have our own land and our own language and our own economy and subsequent Zionist thinkers, Achad Ha'am, added, and our own criminals and our own perverts, that was his lashon, right? Then we'd be normal like the rest of the nations of the world. And they wouldn't hate us any more than they hate each other, which I don't know is any great shakes anyway, but in any case, we wouldn't be singled out. We wouldn't be hated any more than they hate each other. And then that would solve the problem of anti-Semitism. And therefore, Herzl made his agenda to establish a political autonomy, a state, right, in Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael, because that was the most logical place. That's where we had our roots. That's where we originally had that political autonomy. So we should renew that political autonomy in Eretz Yisrael. And he wrote a book and that espoused these ideas. And he gathered a lot of interest, even from people, even Rabbonim. Joined the organization in the beginning because basically it was an organization to establish settlement of Jews in Eretz Yisrael. And what could be wrong with that? The conditions in Europe were terrible. To have the dream that maybe we could resettle Jews in their own country with their own economy and away from the anti-Semitism of Europe, was what could be wrong with that? So many Frum Jews and Rabbanim were part of the Zionist movement in the beginning. But right away, in the beginning of the movement, the Russian Maskilim, the ones we spoke about before, Maskilim, the reformers, who basically for the past 100 years before that, reform movement, the Maskilim, already had an agenda to modernize Klal Yisrael, enlighten them, which means to throw off the yoke of Torah. That's what their agenda was. Reform, and then the Maskilim. And they tried very hard in Europe to wrest the authority from the Rabbanim, from the Frum community, and to secularize Yiddishkeit. And in many places they were successful, in many places they weren't successful, because the authority, the establishment for hundreds of years had been the Rabbanim and the Kehillas that were Frum. So they had a very hard time bucking the establishment. They saw that if Herzl would be successful and they'd be able to create a Jewish homeland, a Jewish state in Eretz Yisrael, then if they were on the bandwagon and they got in at the ground floor, they could establish that state the way they wanted it to be and mold the character of the Jewish people for the future in this state, right, in the way they would like to see it be, meaning totally irreligious, secular. So they jumped on the bandwagon of Zionism. They had a very big influence on Herzl. Like we said, Herzl was very ambivalent to religion. He didn't, Badafka, want to make a secular state, a religious state. Didn't make any difference to him. Whatever it'll be, it'll be. And fight it out then. He just wanted a state so Jews could be normal. But the Russian Maskilim, who had their agenda, very much influenced Herzl. And in his writings, as they progressed, you could see more and more anti-religion. He wrote that the state will have secular marriage, that they will be massacring the Avla. It was a terrible injustice that a Meshumen, a person who converted to Christianity, right, was considered out of the Jewish people. He would write that wrong in this new state, and the Zionist thinkers, the Chad Ha'am, put it very clearly. What is the definition of a Jew? A Jew is defined by nationalism. We're part of the Jewish nation, part of the Jewish state. If you're patriotic to the Jewish state, even if you're a Christian, even if you're married to a Christian, makes no difference. You're a good Jew. Judaism is defined by nationalism and patriotism. And if you're a Frum Jew who's not patriotic, you're not a good Jew. Because Judaism is defined by nationalism, which is apikorsis. No shy of that. Because the Sadia Gaon says very clearly, what defines a Jew is not nationalism. It's not a country, it's not a land, it's one thing, the Torah. And Ein Umasenu Uma Ela B'Torasa, our entire nationalism is based on the Torah. Therefore, you can have a Chinaman, right, who accepts the Torah, is Megayer Kahalacha, and he's a good Jew, even though he's a Chinaman, and he lives in China. And you can have a Jew who lives in Eretz Yisrael who throws off willingly the yoke of Torah, and he's not a good Jew. Or he's not a Jew b'chlal, without being certain halachas. He has a din of a goy. If he shechts an animal, it's treif. If he touches wine, it's usher. Judaism is defined by an allegiance to Torah, not by nationalism, not by allegiance to a country or to a state or whatever. And pushed very much. Again, here they were from people. They were people who were not secular. They were these maskilim. And it was a tremendous struggle within the Zionist movement in the early years of what the agenda of Zionism should be. There were those that said Zionism should limit itself to settling Eretz Israel. What that settlement is going to be is not their business. That's the business of educators, rabbis, whatever. And the Russian Maskilim, and influenced Herzl also, that's not the case. That Zionism has to worry not only of settling Eretz Israel, but what the character of that settlement is going to be. And they have to make us a normal nation without religion. Because religion makes us abnormal too. So we should become normalized. And being in Eretz Israel, we only need religion in Chutz Laretz. In Eretz Israel, you don't need religion to make you different. You're different because you're a Jew who lives in the Jewish country. So your nationalistic identity is the ikkar. In Chutz Laretz, to maintain an identity as Jews, you got to be religious. But in Eretz Israel, you don't need that. Eretz Israel, speaking Hebrew, living in Eretz Israel, is a substitute for Torah. That was their, what's it called, their feeling. And therefore, speaking Hebrew became a substitute for keeping mitzvahs, and living in Eretz Yisrael became a substitute for keeping mitzvahs. And this was the shaila: should Zionism involve itself in culture and education, or only in settlement of Eretz Yisrael? This was the inner argument that came up at the early Zionist congresses. At that time, one of the Choshev HaRabbanim of the time wrote the following. He said, if the Zionist movement is going to continue to press to be involved in culture and education, and put on its banner that Eretz Yisrael and Lashon HaKodesh take the place of mitzvahs, then we rabbis are going to have to de-emphasize Eretz Yisrael completely and put it on a back burner and totally disregard publicly its importance. And he said there's a precedent for that. He said when the early Christians began to say that the only thing in the Torah that is relevant is the Ten Commandments, so the Rabbanan de-emphasized the importance of the Aseres Hadibros. They didn't stop keeping them, but they stopped giving special importance to the Aseres Hadibros, which had been given before that. We used to, in the time of the Second Beis Hamikdash, we used to every day in davening say the Aseres Hadibros as part of Kriyat Shema. Davening was a little bit longer. We recited the Aseres Hadibros and Kriyat Shema together within those brachas of Kriyat Shema. It's part of davening. When the early Christians began to say that the only relevant part of the Torah is the Aseres Hadibros, the Rabbanan said, if we continue to say the Aseres Hadibros every day in davening, then people are going to be confused. And they're going to say, you see, the Christians are right. There is something special about the Ten Commandments. Why do we say that every day? So therefore, they took it out of davening and they made an isser. It's usser to say the Aseres Hadibros is part of davening. Even some will say even after davening, you can't say it. You say it, but it's like in some siddurim, they have the Aseres Hadibros at the end of davening, right? Some people hold you're not allowed to do that. Others hold no, as long as it's not in the actual davening itself, within the brachas of Kriyat Shema, it's okay. In any case, but it's usser. It's usser because of Tarumas HaMinim. Said this Rav, if the Zionists are going to make such a big deal about Eretz Yisrael and make it as if that's all that's important and that takes the place of Torah and mitzvahs, then we rabbis are going to have to de-emphasize the importance of Eretz Yisrael and not mention it, because not to confuse people. You see, the rabbis also think Eretz Yisrael is so important. So we're going to have to just ignore it. Ignore the whole issue and not mention the importance of Eretz Yisrael, not push Eretz Yisrael in order not to give people confusion that maybe the Zionists are right. That Rav, this wrote this in 1911. Now you would imagine that that may have been Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnfeld, or maybe the Satmar Rebbe. The Satmar Rebbe was in short pants at the time, 1911. Or maybe the Munkacher Rebbe, or some of the anti-Zionist rabbis. The one who wrote that was Rav Kook. So just to point out that nobody, including Rav Kook, held that a philosophy that substitutes Eretz Yisrael for the Torah is anything less than not because that's Matthias. Right? Even Rav Kook held like that. In the end, obviously Rav Kook held that it didn't come to a point where they had to do that. And he had other methods of dealing with the Zionist movement. But Lemaisa, the Etzem philosophy that secular Zionism purported was apikorsis. And across the board, everybody agreed with that. It's not a question. The question was only Lemaisa how to deal with it. In any case, early on, right after that, 1912, around then, there was a vote in a Zionist Congress whether Zionism should involve itself with culture and education or not, and the ones who wanted yes won. At that point, most of the religious delegates to the Congress split away from the Zionist movement because they couldn't in good conscience be part of a movement that had on its banner, its agenda, to secularize the Jewish people. And when they split away from the Zionist movement, they started another movement. And that movement was called the Mizrahi, religious Zionists. We want Zionism, but not for the sake of secularizing the Jewish people, just the opposite, to be able to establish a religious community in Eretz Yisrael, a religious state.
What's the source of the word Mizrahi, the name Mizrahi?
What? Mizrahi is the East. Their eyes were towards the East. that was their major focus, we'll see. The Mizrahi movement was made up of Yidden who followed Rabbanim, who had already formulated from before this shittas that were very similar to Zionism, but in a religious vein. In other words, they also saw a positive, important point in nationalism, that having a political entity in Eretz Israel, having a nationalistic body, should be full, was important in itself. And this philosophy was developed, like we said, by the people who basically formed Chovei Beit Zion, Rav Kalischer, Mo'aliver, Alkali, and they, Rav Kalischer, the main one, in Drisha Zion, formulated this concept, and the concept was that Geula happens in a slow process that starts with us and ends with God. In other words, we have to politically redeem ourselves first, and after we will politically redeem ourselves and cause that first level of Geula, which they associated with the concept of Mashiach ben Yosef. Mashiach ben Yosef is the preparation for Mashiach ben David. God will bring Mashiach ben David, that's Mashiach, but before that Mashiach comes, there'll be already redemption. That redemption is we redeem ourselves from Galus, physically and politically, and then God will redeem us after we've redeemed ourselves politically. And they held that that is what it means. Rav Kook eventually adopted this philosophy, and he enlarged it and made it much more clear or whatever. And he became the spokesman for this ideology, but he didn't create it. It preceded him. Most Gedolim disagreed with this, didn't hold of such a thing. They held that they based it on a medrash, right? Not only, but this medrash pretty much epitomizes this idea that Geulas Yisrael is like the dawn, like the shachar. Just like the dawn comes slowly, doesn't come all at once, slow process from night to daylight, so too the Geula is a slow process. So they said that slow process starts with us redeeming ourselves from Galus, and it culminates when Mashiach comes. Most Gedolim held not like that. I heard from Moshe Feinstein, that obviously he wasn't from the Gedolim that were involved in this Shaila, but in retrospect, I heard from Moshe Feinstein directly, not that what he wrote or whatever, I heard him say it at a convention. He said that the concept of Reishis Michus Gulasenu, right, this concept, that there's an idea of the beginning of Geula, right, that Geula already starts when there's political autonomy, is a toast, a mistake, doesn't exist, there is no such thing. There is no such thing as Geula that starts before Mashiach comes. Now, he didn't explain, then what does that medrash mean? He just said that you should know it's a toast. It's not true. What he meant, I think, is the following. The Rambam says, and we we learned this when we learned the Yud Gimel Ikarim, the Rambam says that Mashiach, when will the Geula happen? When somebody will come and claim to be Mashiach. But from that point on, it's a slow process. It's not going to happen, could be, overnight. Because somebody could come and claim to be Mashiach, and he hasn't yet proven it. He just claims to be Mashiach. He has all the credentials of somebody who could be Mashiach. He has to be from, and he has to be a Talmud Chacham, and he has to be Lochem Luchemes Hashem, and he has to, what's it called, be Mashpia on most of Klal Yisrael, whatever the credentials are. So you have to assume that he's the Mashiach. How do you know for sure he's Mashiach? Only one way. Only one way, says the Rambam. If he accomplishes what Mashiach is supposed to accomplish. What is that? To build the Beis HaMikdash and bring all Jews into Eretz Yisrael. If he does that, then he's Mashiach for sure. If he doesn't do that, he's not Mashiach for sure. One or the other. And if he dies, Rambam says, before he does that, he's not Mashiach. Period. He doesn't say we're waiting for him to come back. He says he's not Mashiach. Period. If he didn't do what Mashiach's supposed to do, he's not Mashiach. And it could be he's not a Rasha. It could be that the Rabbanu Shel Olam made him think he was Mashiach to test us. Whatever the reason is, somebody who doesn't build the Beis HaMikdash and bring all Jews into Eretz Israel is not Mashiach. But the process from the time that somebody claims to be Mashiach till he'll actually do that, and then beyond that, till he'll bring the whole world to Avodas Hashem and to believe in God, could take hundreds of years, the Rambam says. So therefore, the process of Geula is, yes, a slow process, but it doesn't culminate with the coming of Mashiach. It begins with the coming of Mashiach. But before Mashiach comes, no such thing as a Geula. There's what the Gemara calls a schauta. The Geula does not mean that the Geula started. The Gemara uses that lashon that the wars that will precede Mashiach are a schauta de Geula. That doesn't mean that the Geula started. It's happening to people in the middle of wars. They haven't won the wars yet. But the process that will lead up to Geula is also called Aschalta de Geula. But not that that's called Geula. Not that we're redeemed. Redemption comes when Mashiach comes. Till then, there's no redemption. Till then, there could be preparations for redemption. In any case, so these shitas held that the Mizrahi adopted that philosophy, that it is crucial in order to bring Mashiach to first redeem ourselves politically. So the aims of secular Zionism, of creating a political entity in Eretz Israel, is important. You have to do that. Most Gedolim held not like that. It held that there's no intrinsic value of having a political entity in Eretz Israel before Mashiach comes. Some held that it's usher to have that, like we said. That's called Yalu B'choma. That's taking Eretz Israel by force. You can live in Eretz Israel, but under Goyim, not under your own rule. Because if you take it away from Goyim, even with political pressure, that's called taking Eretz Israel by force. Most Gedolim held it's not usher to do that, as long as you don't do it by physical force, but there's no inyan to do it. If it'll be beneficial, fine. If it won't be beneficial, right, it'll cause anti-Semitism, whatever it'll cause, or whatever, it's not worth it, then if you can settle Eretz Israel under the rule of others, that's okay. Same mitzvah. To have dafka, political entity, is not a value to itself. This was also machlokus amongst Gedolim. Some held it was usher, some held it was just not important, some held that it was crucial. Around the same time that the Mizrahi started, the Aguda started. The rest of Klal Yisrael, the Haredi Olam, right, that included both Western Europe, Eastern Europe, was spearheaded by the Chafetz Chaim, by the Ger Rebbe, predominantly by Chaim Ozer, right, the recognized Gedolim of the generation, pretty much spearheaded an organized effort that would bring Frum Jewry together called Agudas Yisrael. The Aguda differed from Mizrahi in the point we just meant, is having a political entity in Eretz Yisrael a value or not? The Aguda held it's not. It's no intrinsic value. And therefore, it's better not to put your efforts into that, but to settling Eretz Yisrael. That was, yes, something. Now the second difference was the Mizrahi held that since creating a political entity in Eretz Yisrael is a prelude to Geula, it's Geula, it's the beginning of Geula, so that, what could be more important than that? That was the major agenda of Klal Yisrael, to do that, and to work together with the secular Zionist movement to do it. And that was the third point of the Mizrahi, that even though they couldn't be part of the movement itself, because the movement itself had decided that its purpose was to create a secular state in Eretz Yisrael, but they could work together with it on common ground. In other words, both of them felt that having a state is important. They wanted a secular state, they wanted a religious state. So we'll work together on the state, and then we'll fight over what the nature of the state should be. But we can work together with them on the common ground that we have. Most Gedolei Yisrael disagreed with that, and they said you can't work together with a secular organization, secular movement that's apikorsis. It's not that the people weren't frum. That was not the problem. It was just a matter of working together with non-frum people. That's not the problem. The problem was that the Zionist movement, based on its charter, was apikorsis. It wanted to substitute nationalism for Torah, which is apikorsis, like we said. So there's no common ground. It's like two people want to build a building. One wants a church, one wants a shul. So we'll work on the common ground, the walls. And then we'll decide if it's a church or a shul. That's absurd. Either it's a church or it's a shul. There's no common ground. Either the walls are the walls of a shul or the walls are the walls of a church. There is no common ground. So the Gedolim held you can't work together with an organization that's apikorsis, where the movement, the entire policy is apikorsis. Not that the people aren't frum. That has nothing to do with it. Had to do with the philosophy of the movement. And the Mizrahi held you could work together with them under the same umbrella, even though we're a separate organization. We have our reasons for wanting what they want. They have their reasons, but we want the same thing basically at some point. So those were and the third difference was the Mizrahi held that was the major issue facing Klal Yisrael, to secure a place in Eretz Yisrael where Jews could be autonomous, because that's going to bring Mashiach. And the Aguda held that that wasn't the major issue, since it wasn't the intrinsic value altogether. Settling Eretz Yisrael was important, and they did get involved, but that wasn't the major issue. The major issue was seeing to it that the Jews who lived in Europe at the time could survive. The poverty was terrible. The yeshivas were in a danger of totally collapsing because of financial reasons. And without yeshivas, they said, we haven't lived for a day in Golis without Torah. We've lived 2,000 years without a state. So the state will be the secondary, well, not the state, but settling Eretz Yisrael will be a secondary thing, and supporting Yidden in Europe and the yeshivas in Europe is the major agenda of the Aguda. So those are the three basic differences between the Aguda and the Mizrahi. Until World War I, nothing really happened with secular Zionism. They had a lot of speeches, and they had a lot of congresses, and Herzl spent a lot of money on trying to bribe the Turks to give us land in Eretz Yisrael, and the Turks took the money, but they didn't give anything in return. And it pretty much looked almost impossible to get Eretz Yisrael. Aside from that, a lot of the Zionist leaders who never saw Eretz Yisrael started to take trips to take a look at it. And what they saw, they weren't too happy with. It was a dismal land full of swamps and poverty and backward people. And then they came up, the British had an alternate possibility. Instead of what's it called, Eretz Yisrael, which has a lot of problems because of the Arabs, we'll give you Uganda, which was under British control, and make your state in Uganda. And there was a considerable amount of the Zionist movement that were willing to accept that. Either temporarily, until they can get the force to be able to move it over to Eretz Yisrael, or permanently. There are many that Eretz Yisrael was not an important thing. The main thing was to have a political autonomy. Eretz Yisrael was just because that's the most logical place. But if that's impossible, then have it in Uganda. The main thing was to be normal. So it could be as normal as Idi Amin in Uganda. Why not? It's interesting. Rav Shiva pointed out that the goal of Herzl was to obliterate anti-Semitism by making us a normal nation. Not only hasn't it worked, but it's made new anti-Semitism. Now there's a new, refined anti-Semitism. Used to be anti-Semitism was hating all those Jews with the long noses. And that's very unrefined. Why hate Jews? What have they, you know, what, besides the fact they have long noses, what do they have in common? So that's a very unrefined anti-Semitism. Today, there's a very refined anti-Semitism. We don't hate Jews, Chas v'Shalom. We hate Zionists, Israelis, because they're pushy, they are conquerors, they're aggressive, they are oppressors, and therefore we hate them. Who are the Zionists? All those Jews with the long noses, from the Naturi Karta to the most left-wing secularist. We've just given a new kind of anti-Semitism and it's become established. At least up until the last few years, it was part of the United Nations motion that Zionism and racism are the same thing. Zionism is racism. And if you were a Zionist, you're a racist. And it's only within the last few years that that was repealed. My Shiva Gifter pointed out, here was the Zionist dream, that by becoming a normal nation, the Goyim won't hate us anymore. And now because we're a nation, now they hate us even more. And not only that, we've created a new anti-Semitism that Zionism is racism. She said, look at what country made the motion in the United Nations that Zionism is racism. Uganda. Said, you don't see Yad Hashem, but that same Uganda that they look to, that maybe this is going to be the place that cures anti-Semitism, is the one that made the motion because of Israel, because of Zionism, that now there's a new kind of anti-Semitism that becomes respectable and refined. So, Yad Hashem, is the stira there is unbelievable. In any case, so Herzl died before World War I. And he died basically with a broken heart. He really had no success. He didn't see, there wasn't anybody, pretty much no one who even thought there was a chance that they're ever going to get a state. And what they were hoping was to have some kind of settlement in Eretz Yisrael with some kind of autonomy amongst the Arabs. And it didn't look like it ever was going to happen. The Turks were not interested and there was no way of getting through to them. World War I changed everything insofar that the English had an interest in the Jews helping the war effort, especially monetarily. And they wanted the Zionists on their side for fear that they would go over to the other side, to the Germans, in World War I. And because of that, they wooed the Zionists with a promise that if they won the war, and they became the mandate for Palestine was given to England, which wasn't clear. It could have been divided between England and France. It could be that Eretz Yisrael was going to be made an international zone. But if England would get the mandate on Palestine, they would encourage a homeland for Jews in Eretz Yisrael. So now is a glimmer of hope. Lamaisa, England did win the war. And in 1917, Lord Balfour made his famous Balfour Declaration in the name of the government, right, that His Majesty's government looks favorable on the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Now, it didn't say a state, right? It said a homeland, which could be a state, could be not a state. It was a very vague declaration on purpose, in order not to anger the Arabs too much, to be vague enough that they could, you know, get out of as much as they wanted to get out of. But it was something. They say that when the Chafetz Chaim heard about, the people went crazy. They were dancing in the streets as if, you know, Mashiach had come. Lord Balfour said that there's a chance that the Jews are going to be able to go back to Eretz Israel and have a homeland. So the world was, the Jewish world was rejoicing. So the Chafetz Chaim, they say, cried when he heard. And they asked him why he's crying. He said that for this we waited 2,000 years. This is it. that some guy should say that they look favorably on letting us go back to Eretz Yisrael, and that's what we should rejoice about. Right? This is it, this is the goal, the Mashiach came, because Lord Balfour said that the government looks favorable, and they didn't give us anything. Nothing happened. Just some guy said that, maybe. So the Chofetz Chaim cried, and he said, this is what we're celebrating. This is what we waited 2,000 years for. On the other hand, they say that Rabbi Yosef Chaim von Sonnenfeld, when he heard, was very, very happy. And his Talmidim asked him, you know, am I high? What's to be happy about this? Because some guy said, he said to them, if for 2,000 years it hasn't rained, and there hadn't been a cloud in the sky for 2,000 years, and you woke up one morning and you saw a little puffy cloud, the first cloud in 2,000 years, no rain, but it's the first cloud in 2,000 years, wouldn't you be happy? It's the same thing. Lamaisa, for 2,000 years, there hasn't been any hope, no nothing. All of a sudden, right, they're starting to talk about, let's go back there. It's just something to be happy about. So there was the half a glass of water that was full and the half glass that was empty, but Lamaisa, there was something that happened. The Balfour Declaration was something. We're going to stop here and continue next week with this, but next week is Yom HaTzmaut.
No, it was Tuesday.
Is what? Tuesday? Ah, okay, so we'll have a shiur next week. But just to point out that the Balfour Declaration was very short-lived. The English realized that they made a big mistake because the Arabs were not very happy with the Balfour Declaration, to put it mildly. And they realized that they needed the Arabs a lot more than they needed the Jews. And very quickly, they pretty much made the Balfour Declaration irrelevant. It came out with the famous white paper, and that's what we'll start with in Yirtzeh Hashem next week.